Well, should I start maybe by doing those two readings again,
just to put them alongside
each other? Okay. Here's a passage from Lines Written a Few Miles Above Tintern Abbey in Received Pronunciation, the accent that I'm now using. And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns and the round ocean and the living air and the blue sky and in the mind of man, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things. Now, the same passage in a very tentative reconstruction of Wordsworth's kind of accent. And remember that accent isn't the only thing that's involved in getting a sense of what a person's voice was like. And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns, and the round ocean and the living air, and the blue sky and in the mind of man, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things. Well, I suppose I'd like to start by saying why I got interested in this. And I have to admit that initially I didn't know why I got interested in it, but I think, looking back, I can see. There's a sort of poetry of motive which reveals itself gradually over time, and you may be drawn to things without being very fully aware of the reasons why you are. And I think that I was drawn to the consideration of Wordsworth's voice and accent because my own voice felt, through the processes of education, not like my own. Because when I was a boy, I used to speak like this. And then gradually, you know, I went to school, various colleges, and people taught me that that wasn't a very good way of speaking. And so I learnt to speak like this. And you can see that they're quite different. And one of the respects in which they're different is that they're perceived as different. Because it would be a reasonable question why I exchanged the Welsh accent for what we could loosely call the English one, and not the other way round. I mean, why don't people, you know, in the process of education, shed their English accents and start speaking in Welsh ones, or Scottish ones, or Irish ones, or whatever it is? Well, they don't because of the prestige that's accorded to a particular accent in our culture, and that accent's received pronunciation. But it hasn't existed for very long, because it depends for its existence on two things: standardisation of English usage and mass broadcasting. Clearly there was standardisation of English usage long before there was mass broadcasting, and you can tell from things like Burns's poems that he was very, very well aware of the standardisation of English. So if you look at a volume like this volume, much beloved by Wordsworth, Burns's poems chiefly in the Scottish dialect, you open it up, and the first thing you read is, "The following trifles are not the production of the poet, who, with all the advantages of learned art, and perhaps amid the elegancies and idlenesses of upper life, looks down for a rural theme with an eye to Theocritus or Virgil." Well, clearly that's written in an idiom, a syntax and a diction, which is consistent with the one that we're using now. But then, the moment that you open up the volume, and you see things like, "Here Doon poured his far-fetched floods," where down is written D-O-O-N, and in capital letters, we realise that there are two voices in this volume. And the first voice is clearly addressed to the group of people who are expected to be buying the book. The second voice, we presume, is closer to Burns's native voice, and it belongs to the people that he grew up among, who were responsible partly for the formation of his sensibility, and whom he imaginatively is addressing. So when the poet is writing the poem, the question of, you know, the audience is a very subtle one. Lots of people think that it's a matter of very consciously envisaging a group of people. But for many poets, it's very important that they don't do that, that they have a vague subliminal sense of whom this might be going out to. Edward Thomas said that the reason that silence was important when you're composing a poem is that the silence actually becomes your ideal listener. And that means that your fantasy can, your imagination can operate upon the silences to produce a fantasy of the person who's receiving your words. And that person will be perfectly attuned to you and will understand all the assumptions and values that are built into the particular way that you are speaking, though you may not be speaking aloud. So the actual process of composition is a complex one. Anyway, Burns, clearly it moves between these two voices, and in fact writes poems in both the dialectal voice and the standardised voice. And it becomes a question how far the voice in which he spoke or imagined himself speaking the poems changed when he was using the two different kinds of idiom, idiom and accent being distinct. So I think that I was therefore, you know, drawn to this question of what Wordsworth sounded like, because I'd become aware that there was something about the way that I sounded which didn't seem quite all of how I imagine myself. Mm. Because if the sound of your voice carries with it traces of everything that you have been up till the moment you're speaking, then any change in the sound of your voice may eliminate some of those changes and may actually involve feelings of disloyalty and loss.
That makes it sound in some ways that for you the study of poetry is perhaps a quest for an understanding of something about your own psychology, about your own person, your own personality. I wonder, considering that Wordsworth is a poet who spends so much of his career reflecting upon how it is that he came to be the person that he is, that the study of aspects of his accent might reveal something of his character, of his psychology, that may not be available to us purely on a textual level, but has to be considered on the oral and the acoustic level.
Well, I think that's true. I didn't quite get into it in the way that you've suggested. I'm sure that what you've said is there. And obviously you do make it sound as though my motives for being interested in Wordsworth are very egotistical. I suppose in a certain sense they are. But maybe we could have a distinction between egotistical and narcissistic. You know, that you're trying, you're interested in poetry because you're interested in yourself, and I suppose that that's generally true. But if you're interested in only in yourself, then you can't be interested in poetry because it's somebody else, or it's partly somebody else. The question is what's going on when you and the poet meet in that sort of curious, imaginative relation that constitutes reading. And I think that what happened with me and Wordsworth was initially I found him quite difficult to read. I was very drawn to something in him, but also felt a bit alienated. And I wasn't sure about the reasons for this. And ultimately, as you know, I came to think that many of the reasons for that are to do with cultural change, and that, you know, there is a big process of alienation that's gone on. And that it is, to a large extent, in my admittedly controversial opinion, unrecognised. Because one of the things that we might do is develop a sort of false consciousness about what's going on in Wordsworth, so that we can make him more amenable to ourselves. And I wasn't able to do that because I wasn't at one with what I thought of as the linguistic orthodoxy that might actually have subsumed Wordsworth. So if I had felt that the pronunciation that I'm now speaking was fully me, then I would have been entirely happy about absorbing Wordsworth into it. But because I didn't think that it was fully me, then absorbing Wordsworth into it only made him less intelligible and companionable for me. So I had an interest in trying to see whether Wordsworth's relation to received pronunciation might be more like my own. And it is an odd thing that Wordsworth is clearly read in many places other than the southeast of England. But the southeast of England has a particular sort of dominance or prominence. And we may get back to, rather like the sort of pre-industrial segregation of accents, or segregation in the awareness of other accents. At the time when Wordsworth was alive, most people never travelled more than, well, probably more than 20, 50 miles from where they were born. that meant that the their awareness of other accents was very limited, and they would often, you know, react with great surprise to encountering somebody who spoke in a different way from themselves. When Wordsworth made his frequent trips down to London, Londoners certainly noticed that his accent was very different from theirs. And even people who were not Londoners, you know, noticed something distinctive about his accent. I put together just a few fairly obvious and well-known comments about this. Carlyle, in his reminiscences, and you know, Carlyle obviously you know, comes from outside of, you know, the English literary establishment, and he says in his reminiscences of 1881 that there was a fine limpid vein of melody too in him, as of an honest rustic fiddle, good and well handled, but wanting two or more of the strings, and not capable of much. Now the interesting thing there is the suggestion of limitation, but the limitation goes along with fineness. And that fineness is something to do with Carlyle's perception that Wordsworth actually isn't middle class. Rustic is the word that comes up, and it comes up again. His voice was good, frank and sonorous, though practically clear, distinct and forcible, rather than melodious. Something that lots of people, including Coleridge, comment on, that Wordsworth's voice was very steady, very level, that he liked to compose walking up and down a gravel path, whereas Coleridge liked to compose wandering through rough ground, open country. People said that that Coleridge had a dramatic style of reading, you know, whereas Wordsworth had a much more declamatory style of reading. So Coleridge, you know, would have been somebody that people were happy to encourage to read at parties, whereas Wordsworth might not have been. Anyway, Carlyle goes on, the tone of him businesslike, sedately confident, no discourtesy, yet no anxiety about being courteous, a fine, wholesome rusticity, fresh as his mountain breezes, sat well on the stalwart veteran, and on all he said and did. Well, this is not... You see how quickly this moves away from talking about Wordsworth's voice to talking about what clearly is, in some sense, his moral character or his moral bearing, a fine, wholesome rusticity. And, you know, you might think of there of something like Seamus Heaney's response. Again, sort of Seamus Heaney is outside of the English... called a kind of orthodoxy of accent, and he says that he finds in Wordsworth, you know, suggestions of well-earned repose, and it's that repose which is somehow attractive to many people, that Wordsworth has secured something which most of us want, and this seems to be bound up with the way that the poetry sounds or intimates that it might have sounded. And Carlyle, who's actually remembering Wordsworth's voice, which he has heard, finds in it a fine, wholesome rusticity. And this is much to do, again, with the feeling that Wordsworth is at one with the people that he lived among. Even though he would have been perceived by them as a gentleman, quite a number of the people who wrote reminiscences of Wordsworth said that when they first met him, you know, that they thought that he might have been one of his own neighbours, because of the way that he looked. But it was only once he started talking about poetry they realised that he wasn't. And then Hazlitt most famously says, a mixture of clear gushing accents in his voice, a deep guttural intonation, and a strong tincture of the northern burr, like the crust on wine. Well, that makes it absolutely clear, you know, that Wordsworth had some kind of northern accent. And the burr, that's a complex word if you look it up in OED, but it often has to do with trilled R's. And if you think of the fact that even now, trilling the R is a very distinctive trait of many Scottish varieties of English, and you think of how close the Lake District is to Scotland, and you think of, you know, that in relation to the fact that probably Burns is the single most important recent lyric poet in Wordsworth's experience, then, you know, it wouldn't be surprising if you had lots of people in the Lake District who trilled that particular sound. So when Wordsworth came down to London, that would have been quite a surprise for people of, let's say, Henry Crabb Robinson's literary circle to encounter. Well, what does it mean? Well, one of the things that it means is that Wordsworth's class allegiances might have felt different to him and to his contemporaries, in the same way that Seamus Heaney's do. In Ireland, I don't think that there is a widespread perception of Heaney as middle class. It's partly because the class structure of what you could call the outlying countries of the UK is different from the class structure of England. So Heaney in Ireland, you know, seems like a, you know, somebody who's interested in and involved in literature, but who speaks in all, his voice is the same as that of many of the people who aren't interested in literature. Whereas in England, the moment that you use the accent that we are using, received pronunciation, you are announcing that you are part of an educated minority. And the fact that we implicitly and without question read the poets that we read in this accent might mean that we're subjecting them to a kind of sociological transformation, that we're turning them into something not only that they weren't, but that they wouldn't have wanted to be. You know, Wordsworth's determination to express his allegiance to the statesman of the Lake District is absolutely unmistakable. And from our point of view, that's a class allegiance. He's saying that there is something that these people with very little formal education know that many people with a lot of formal education don't know. And therefore, the fact that he may have sounded rather like them may have been very important to him. And it may have accounted for the fact that he didn't want to live in London, and he didn't indeed want to live very far away from the Lake District. Coleridge said that there was something about the sound of the voices around him in the Lake District that to Wordsworth was incalculably dear, you know, that he had to have that sound around him. And I put it to you that you know, that's rather like Edward Thomas's silence, that what Wordsworth needed to hear around him was the sound of these working class, for the most part illiterate, northern voices, which had built into them a whole system of values, a whole perceptual system that maybe more middle class English people in the south had become alienated to some extent from. You know, I'm putting this a bit too strongly, perhaps, but something like that, I think, is going on. That the sound that Wordsworth can hear around him is a symbol of the values that command his deepest allegiances, and that when he's away from that sound, he somehow feels estranged from himself. So, you know, your question about the psychology of composition, I think it was necessary for Wordsworth to have that sound in his own head, associated with his own voice, in order to feel that he was speaking from the culture that had made him, rather than feeling that he was speaking from the educational establishment that had given him an accent, which is very often the situation, I think, of people who've gone through our kind of process. Maybe you'd like me to talk a bit about reconstructing Wordsworth's accent, you know, a hard and fast thing rather than these speculative.
Yes, because it would be fascinating to try to understand how it is that one goes about trying to reconstruct the notion of what Wordsworth might have sounded like, and what sort of evidence one uses in order to inform your sort of attempt to recreate the sound of his particular diction, for speaking, given the problem of the gulf of history that lies between us and Wordsworth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is a serious problem, and clearly, you know, with any poets since the arrival of recording, then, you know, the problem is simplified to some degree. As you'll know, you know, we've got very scratchy wax cylinder recordings of Tennyson. We've got quite good recordings of Yeats, and, you know, really from Yeats onwards, we've got recordings of nearly all canonical poets. But with Wordsworth, what we're thrown upon is, I think, three things. First of all, there's the evidence within the poems themselves, rhymes, particularly rhymes. Second, we've got the testimony of such people as I've quoted. You can pick up suggestions about Wordsworth's accents from what people say about it, although it has to be admitted that sometimes this testimony is rather disappointingly imprecise. And then third, and this is something that I relied on quite a bit initially, you've got the probability that in the Lake District, local accents have been less subject to change than they have in the southeast of England, or indeed in places like Oxford and Cambridge. I suppose that there is a danger that I might overemphasize this point, but there's also a danger that I might underemphasize it. So I'll take the risk. In Cambridge and in Oxford, it seems to me that the homogenizing tendency of formal education on accent is formidable. It seems to be the case that a very high proportion of people who go to Oxford and Cambridge do indeed come from England and do indeed come from the southeast of England. But even those who don't, they often end up sounding, as I do, as if they did. And, you know, that's because of the tremendous, colossal prestige that is attaches to this particular accent. But the moment that you start moving away from, you know, the Oxbridge-London triangle, you become aware that local accents have been very much more rugged and durable. They're still nothing like as durable as they would have been 100 years back before there was ease of transport. But nonetheless, you know, if you go to Cornwall, if you go to most parts of Ireland, if you go to Scotland, if you go to Lake District, if you go to Wales, if you go to remote East Anglia, if you go out in Norfolk, you start hearing accents which sound like they're consistent with the accents of 100 years ago. So what I did when I started working on Wordsworth's accent, after having been, you know, baffled and disappointed by the contemporaneous accounts of it, was I spoke to people who had lived in the Lake District all their lives, and I got one of them in particular who was the... he used to be the warden of Dove Cottage, and he'd lived in and around Grasmere his whole life. And at the time that I spoke to him, I suppose he was about 50, and I got him to record a selection of poems and passages that I gave him. And I also gave them to Christopher Ricks and one or two other people, so that I could compare this body of recordings in some detail. What changes an accent most quickly is vowels. Consonants remain relatively stable, so that, you know, a sound like t or s or z, you know, is unlikely to have changed massively, although its incidence distribution may do. But vowels change very quickly. And, you know, you can hear that in our culture all the time. And with mass broadcasting, of course, that process has been greatly accelerated. I emphasise that point so that people don't think that the rate of change has always been as rapid as it is now. So something like, I don't know, the way that Afro-Caribbean accents have got into London or estuary English, that wouldn't have happened if there wasn't broadcasting at anything like the speed that it has happened, because people can hear those accents who are not physically within reach of them. So, you know, I think we're living in a slightly falsified auditory world at the moment. And even if you go back sort of 20, 30 years, the rate of change would have been much slower. So I learnt phonetics so that I would be able to transcribe these accents. And probably the most important thing that I learnt from doing that is that studying phonetics for a literary student gets you into the habit of attending to sound rather than to spelling. And that's important for a number of reasons. It's not just important so that you actually hear what people have said, the sound of what they've said. It's important so that, because it puts you more in touch with the probable way in which Wordsworth and his contemporaries were used to experiencing poems. Because we know that Wordsworth, Coleridge, Shelley, Byron all went round speaking their poems to each other. And because we know that Wordsworth could compose at, you know, to the extent of maybe 50 lines of blank verse in his head without writing, without going indoors to dictate it, significantly dictate it rather than not write it down, because we know that that went on, his relation to sound must have been very different from our relation to it. And so he must... It's really a grave error to think that a poem is a collection of printed words. A poem is a sequence of sounds. It's a flow of sounds. And the habit of studying phonetics gets you more into the habit of thinking of just a sequence of speech sounds. unfortunately, even when you've done the sort of reconstruction that I attempted by looking at rhyme, I'll just mention a couple of rhymes. At the beginning of Resolution and Independence, for example, you get, if I read it in Received Pronunciation, there was a roaring in the wind all night, the rain came heavily and fell in floods, but now the sun is rising calm and bright, the birds are singing in the distant woods. Over his own sweet voice the stock dove broods, the jay makes answer as the magpie chatters, and all the air is filled with pleasant noise of waters. Well, we're so used to not really paying very much attention to sound that we might not notice that a couple of those rhymes don't work. And we might say, well, they're I rhymes. But the concept of an I rhyme would have been alien to Wordsworth, not least because he's probably composing this in his head before he sees it. And anyway, pararhyme, as we understand it, I always associate really with, roughly with the time of Wilfred Owen, and you don't find conscious attempts at pararhyme in my experience, you know, in poetry written in English in the UK much before that. Emily Dickinson, however, you know, does seem to be experimenting with it sooner. But anyway, if we now read this in a reconstruction of Wordsworth's accent, there was a roaring in the wind all night, the rain came heavily and fell in floods, but now the sun is rising calm and bright, the birds are singing in the distant woods. Over his own sweet voice the stock dove broods, the jay makes answer as the magpie chatters, and all the air is filled with pleasant noise of watters. Well, obviously chatters and watters, but probably also floods and woods. See, well, another thing that happens here is that you begin to notice after a while that Wordsworth quite often is using a long monophthong, that's to say a long single vowel, where modern Received Pronunciation uses a diphthong, so that the effect very often is to, it's like floods, the effect very often is to stretch out a word. So, and I'd suggest that if he's got also this tendency to speak with a restricted dynamic range, that's to say to speak with a relatively small gap between the lowest pitches and the highest pitch in his voice, then those frequent elongations of vowel sound would also have contributed to a sense of the levelness of Wordsworth's voice. And then again, if you think of something like Chatter's Waters, you see, you get the opposite effect when you restore Wordsworth's pronunciation, Chatter's Watters, where you've got a kind of a clipped and an abrupt closing to the stanza, which is rather at odds, you know, with the laziness and sonorousness of it earlier on. And then right at the end, you get a crucial imperfect rhyme as a result of Received Pronunciation at a crucial point. And soon with this the other matter blended, cheerfully uttered with demeanour kind, but stately in the main. And when he ended, I could have laughed myself to scorn to find in that decrepit man so firm a mind. God, said I, be my help and stay secure. I'll think of the leech-gatherer on the lonely moor. Secure, moor. God, said I, be my help and stay secure. I'll think of the leech-gatherer on the lonely moor. Almost certainly that would have been what Wordsworth said. And so, you know, we find ourselves, if we're paying attention to the sound, we find ourselves distracted by a non-rhyme or a not quite perfect rhyme, where actually what we should be hearing is a full rhyme. Although it's a full rhyme, typically, with a fallen cadence. Any diphthong does have a fallen cadence. It tends to go from the first vowel to the second vowel, from a higher note, higher pitch to a lower pitch. And these are often the means by which we get little intimations of melancholy in Wordsworth and indeed many other poets. So it's very important, I think, that we hear them. A sort of final striking example of a rhyme word that, you know, points to, or a pair of rhyme words that point to a change in pronunciation is this from Lines Written in Early Spring. I heard a thousand blended notes while in a grove I sat reclined, in that sweet mood when pleasant thoughts bring sad thoughts to the mind. Now, if you look through the rest of the stanzas, link rang, think man, bower wreathes, flower breathes, you know, it's clear that these rhyme ABAB. So when we encounter notes, thoughts, there must be something wrong. I heard 1,000 blended notes, as in a grove I sat, well, in a grove I sat reclined, in that sweet mood when pleasant thoughts bring sad thoughts to the mind. Notes, thoughts. Well, we've got a letter from Wordsworth where he writes the word note, N-A-U-G-H-T, note. Remember that spelling isn't standardised until after, really, after Wordsworth dies, around about 1850, it gets completely standardised. Wordsworth spells in accordance with what he thinks he sounds like. So clearly he hears the sound N-O-T-E, so not note, but naught. And again, you've got that elongation of sound, which is suggesting, you know, a different way of him imagining the note, not the note, but the naught. See, Carlyle's impression of rusticity in Wordsworth is partly a matter of him, Wordsworth, seeming to take the edge off what seem, in Burns's terms, elegancies of expression. Not saying note, if indeed that was the current London pronunciation, but saying naught. But it also suggests that there is a kind of strength and levelness and business-like quality in Wordsworth, even when he is most preoccupied and disturbed. Just on that last point of disturbance, I could finish. I won't read any more examples after this. From the second stanza of I Wandered Lonely. The waves beside them danced, but they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. A poet could not but be gay in such a laughing company. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the show to me had brought. In Wordsworth, the waves beside them danced, but they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. A poet could not but be gay in such a laughing company. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the shore to me had brought. I gazed and gazed, I gazed and gazed. You see how even that single shift produces much more of a suggestion of steady, unremitting attention. Gazed, 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 gazed. That shifts, if you like, that disrupts the gaze. That shift in the vowel. So, you know, I think that it's ultimately a very, very profound matter, and that the perception of Wordsworth's whole character as a poet depends on minutiae like these. If I could just call attention to somebody who was very well aware of this kind of thing. Hugh Kenner wrote an essay on teaching poetry. In which he said that he was often bothered by the fact that if you ask students to read out, they stumble all over the place and they don't seem like they're doing a familiar thing, which suggests that we've not only gone from the practice of hearing poems spoken and then hearing them imaginatively, we've gone to the practice of reading them from the page and then eventually reading them silently from the page, so that we're at several removes from the kind of experience that Wordsworth would have had. And he says, in our century we have the advantage of the poet's very voice is preserved. And then he gives some examples of things you can hear, and then he says, you can hear Basil Bunting doing brigflats in the authentic Northumbrian, a phase of his lifelong protest against the BBC, for which he once read Wordsworth's Michael, using the vowels and burrs, Hazlitt's word, which he shared with Wordsworth, and he said, with Spenser and Swinburne. Now you can see that what Bunting was trying to do, according to Kenner, is to reclaim the regionality of these poets and everything that implies from the awful subsuming dominance of London received pronunciation, not London-based received pronunciation. And then Kenner goes on, hearing such things can be the beginning of wisdom for students uncowed by the acoustic presence. One thing the poet knows about his verse, and this seems to me extraordinarily brilliant and profound and way beyond what you get in, you know, a lot of criticism of poetry. One thing the poet does know about his verse is how it sounded before it had all its words to distract us. And, you know, what he's getting there, he's getting on the inside of the process of composition. Many many writers, even if they're talking about revisions, they talk about poems as though they were always words. But they often start as not words. They often start as vague impulses that gradually assume some kind of sonic form. The most famous example is Shelley, we've got quite a lot of manuscripts of Shelley, which consist of his notations of sound. So he will write down things like na-na-na-na-na, na-na-na-na-na-na, na-na-na, as N-A, with dashes after. So that's what he's getting as a first intimation of the poem's arrival. And Seamus Heaney talks about one's ear incubating a cadence, as if what you start from is the cadence, then you let your ear sit on it like a hen on an egg, and then the poem comes out of that noise. So whatever that noise is, whatever the general quality of that noise is, it's very important to be able to get back to it. And I think that the study of a poem by Wordsworth might help us to do that. It also pleases me greatly to see one page before the bit that I quote from Kenner. He says, generally I read the lines out myself with a force propelled by a heritage of Welsh preachers. So again, it may be the fact that Kenner is intimate with a different cultural tradition in which sound is very important, that alerts him to the possible importance of sound in other poets.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much for giving me the time.
Okay, great pleasure. Thanks.